This is Emerging Social and Technology Trends. And before I introduce the actual panelists, let me tell you a bit of what we're kind of striving for here. We're going to toss out some, you know, hopefully big, interesting ideas. Yeah, we've got a pretty rangy, eclectic crew with lots of interesting things to say. You know, they come from some familiar companies and have worked for some familiar brand names. They're also going to be a little rogue, where they're going to toss out some, you know, kind of interesting, potentially bombastic ideas. And, you know, we'll have a Q&A session where you can kind of, you know, ask what you want. But, you know, they're kind of tossing out ideas, partly just to get them out there. So let me first introduce myself. I'm Laura Moorhead. I'm a senior editor with Wired. I've worked with both the magazine and the online crew. And I'm simply going to be moderating. To my left, we have Robert Fabricant, and he's the executive creative director for Frog Design. And he's been there 6 years, and he leads them looking into new markets and creative kind of projects. He has worked with MTV, Virgin Mobile, BBC, and a slew of other companies. And he's also an adjunct professor at NYU with their multimedia program. And then we have Andrew Bloom. And he is a New York-based writer. He works, he's a contributing editor with Metropolis and with Wired Magazine. You've seen his byline in a whole bunch of magazines from The New York Times, The New Yorker, Business Week, and Slate. And he, one thing I find interesting on Andrew is he actually, one of his degrees, human geography, which I think will be kind of interesting when we talk about the impacts of space with what's happening now. Then we have Elliot Van Buskirk, and he is the writer behind Listening Post, which is a blog and then also a column on Wired News. And he's been covering music ever since a coworker of his had the first MP3 player at CNET. He also wrote the book Burning Down the House, Ripping, Recording, Remixing, and More. And he often is the music writer who's not writing about all the songs or the cool bands, but is actually looking at how users are kind of changing the industry and, you know, even pays attention to a lot of the, you know, interesting or boring but important legislation that's happening right now. And then we have Daniel Raffer, who is a product manager with Yahoo. He's with their advanced development team, and he's recently launched or working on Pipes, which is an early stage project that lets developers mash up web data. And I'm sure he's going to tell us kind of what mashup web data totally means. He's worked with ABC Online, Condé Nast, and NYU's Innovation Lab. And he also co-founded two record labels, Lucky Kitchen and Apartment B, and he's actually trained as a chef. And then we end with Pete Rojos, and co-founder, best known probably for his work with Engadget. He's the editor-in-chief there. He also blogs for Joystick. And he's in the past been a contributor to Cargo, a columnist for The Guardian, and has written for a whole bunch of magazines and publications from The Times to Fortune and Slate. And one of my favorite stories on Pete is I remember before he went to Engadget and he was working for Nick Denton and that whole blogging empire, saying, I got to figure out how I got to get, you know, more of a play in this thing. And then he's like, I think I'm going to go do my own thing. And he did, and he's done well from it. So this is the crew, and I'm going to start, you know, just by tossing out the question of what is the relationship or kind of the intersection between social trends and technology. Let's kind of set a framework for us with that.
Are we starting at the end and working our way down?
All right, we can do that.
Okay. I mean,
you guys are very civilized. That's good.
Very easy to answer such a focused question. I think what we're seeing is more and more is that technology is driving a lot of social change in our society. And technology is something that is no longer seen as a sort of a separate sphere that is dominated by, you know, professionals or people who are technical experts. It's something that everyday people can affect and drive. And that's, you know, been facilitated in large part by the internet. And I think what's going on is that these new technologies of connection and interaction are creating lots of new forms and mediums and are democratizing media And then they're having effects in the ways that we, you know, interact with each other, the ways that we live our lives, but also really in the ways that we understand and think about ourselves. And I think that's what's causing a huge shift. And it's not just, you know, in the sense, when you think about, you know, I talk mainly about gadgets and personal technology and stuff like that. And, you know, this idea of always being connected and being connected through this device you carry in your pocket is really changing the way that we think about ourselves and the way that we think about our place in society. And I think that that technology is driving social change, but technology is also being affected by the fact that now it is a social medium and it is being driven by the people who actually are using it now.
Add that I feel like one of the things that has been most interesting is what people have been adding into the systems, not just being sort of consumers, and but actually sort of purveyors and extending networks and frameworks in ways that are actually making the entire ecosystem more interesting and adding flavors that perhaps wouldn't have been there originally by the producers of either the site or the distribution endpoint. So it's just becoming a more interesting and more unique place for people to come and actually find and make their tools relate to what interests them. And I think we've been seeing a lot of that the last year or two in particular.
And I think you both have done a fine job, and I'm gonna pass on to the right.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'd add to that when, as soon as you step outside the sort of bubble of thinking in a 12 to 18 month cycle of new trends and new technologies, the speed that everything has changed in the last 10 years is kind of astounding, particularly compared to the way other things change, like cities, and to sort of recognize how quickly it's changing, maybe not by the terms of technology, but by the terms of the sort of physical world we live in, is pretty striking.
To keep it going, I think that you know, there I think a traditional historical view always kind of confirms that technologies don't really propagate until there's kind of a social basis and a cultural need that they're addressing. But I do think that we've seen in the last couple of years a change in that people's whole sense of social identity is much more bound up with the social technologies and communication technologies that they use. So because of that, I think the relationship is getting more complex as people try and understand their position, their social position, much more through how it's reflected back in these medium. And so I think that from that perspective, I think that it's much harder to separate out social trends and technical trends from each other. And I think because of that, people's sense of social security right now has been affected by it. I think people's sense of their grounding and their position in society is something that they're checking on a daily basis through their BlackBerry and through their email to try and continue to confirm their understanding of their state in society in a way that was not true a few years ago.
You know, maybe over the last 18 months, if we take a look back, what were some of like the trends or disruptions kind of jumping off where, you know, we've been seeing a lot of this play out, the whole interaction of social and tech. What would be the disruptions that kind of happened in the last 18 months that might have a ripple effect for us now?
Well, since I passed before, I guess I'll chime in now. One thing that I've been seeing a lot of, and I'm sure everybody in this room has been seeing, is these widgets that kind of go across the entire internet and sort of, it's almost like they're doing to the internet what the internet did to the world, which is like take away the sense of place from it. And so, you know, one widget, I just was looking at this this company called Indy911 that has a widget called Hookah that enables basically anybody who's looking at this widget, no matter where they are on the web, they can chat with each other and listen to the same music and buy MP3s and look at the same photos. And so it kind of brings them to the same spot, even though they might be splintered throughout thousands of different sites. So I think that's kind of a trend right now.
That kind of gets us, I think, on the subject of just place, which kind of in our preparation I know we've talked on. How is place changing?
Well, I think... again, it's sort of it is in some ways a disruptive technology. Another similar site that I've been really interested in is Places with a Z, PLAZES. And I don't know if Stefan, who runs it, is here in the audience, maybe, who I've never met. I only sort of know him by where he is on his Places dashboard. But he But the idea is that it sort of reconnects, it's sort of geographic social networking. It reconnects where you are, it reconnects your online identity to where you are. So you sort of register your MAC address and then show up on a dashboard compared to other people. And it's quite young, and it's hard to tell sort of how it, what the consequences will be. But what's incredibly exciting to me is suddenly, rather the sort of the sort of geographic anonymity of the web becomes, or of your online presence generally, is put back into place, which is how we all live. And then whether that's shown, sort of mashed up in a Google map, or whether you're sort of have a live tracking on your blog, or in whatever other way that that you're sort of making your presence known, not just on IM or on email, but actually sort of putting that on a map, and with the assumption that you're sort of reconnecting that to your physical life as well, to the people you meet face to face, is pretty interesting and connected as well to the neighborhood, the sort of the neighborhood sites like outside.in. Which again, sort of, it's not really clear how those are shaping up, as they certainly are powerful in the way they reconnect all the stuff that's floating around online to where we live.
I mean, I think that ties into the sort of the larger macro trend of people having a really different sense of privacy than we did even 5 or 10, or especially 20-25 years ago. And there was a great cover story in New York Magazine a few weeks ago about how the younger generation of kids who the idea of putting stuff out there, of being very, very revelatory about yourself and about your life and your what you're doing, they're totally comfortable with that. And the idea that you might want to keep large swaths of your life private and hidden from view, it doesn't make sense to them. And it seems like sort of, I feel like myself personally, kind of straddling that generation and the one that's older than me, and kind of feeling in some respects really conflicted about how much do I want to reveal about myself, and I don't want to feel old when I don't blog about everything I'm doing, should I sign up for Twitter, right? And then meeting kids who are like 14 or 15 and them thinking that it's weird that I don't put every photo I take on Flickr, or that I'm not blogging everything I do, or that I don't really update any of my personal information on my MySpace page. And I think that there is sort of a real shift. The technology has driven a transformation in the way that we understand ourselves, and people feel more and more comfortable having this public online persona that has a tremendous amount of detail about themselves. And it's about negotiating those two personas, the private and the personal.
But do you think that people still, even kids, have some sense of that as a representation? It's partly
that's what I'm saying.
It.
Like they're negotiating,
they're seeing it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, they're constantly negotiating this public self and this private self, and yeah. The public self has changed. It's become more amplified. It's more revelatory than it once was before. And I think that kids understand that there is a difference, but their sense of what should be public is much different than it was for most people 15 or 20 years ago.
I think that it's very easy to look at that as a generational thing between kids and us old fogies, and I'm certainly extremely happy that my 20s were cloaked in darkness and not under the lens of the internet. But at the same time, I think that there is the exact same trend in sort of the business world and in a sort of different demographic, but it's just represented differently, and it is represented by that sort of checking of email, that IM, that sense of connection and representation in sort of an information economy and a business economy, to me is very much the same trend, and people are much more open, in terms of how they IM at work, how they represent themselves at work, how available they are to people. Mm-hmm. It's very much the same thing, and I think they feel that same sense of kind of this representation of a sort of uber self, a sort of superhero version of themselves that can keep up with all this crazy busy and that blurring of public and of business and pleasure is another sign of it. And I think in general, one of the things that we keep encountering at Frog is when we go and do a lot of ethnography, is that a lot of our clients do have kind of this somewhat safe assumption they're making,
that a lot of what they're seeing is really only impacting this room. It's only impacting a certain sort of fringe of you know, the demographics in this country. And when you go and talk to people, it may be a less visible effect. It's not like, you know, all these people have a blog where they're posting, you know, pictures every day. But at the same time, it is a subterranean effect that I think is connecting a lot more rapidly across demographics and not just purely, you know, isolated to people like us.
You know, Elliot, I have a question for you on the same topic. But, you know, a lot of times, you know, Pete's kind of talked, you know, you guys both kind of talked on how it's kind of like a universal kind of opening of, you know, a lot of information, a lot of connectivity. You, to some extent, deal with a lot of people in the music world who are, for whatever reason, a little more underground, whether they're trying to keep below notice of, you know, record labels, big companies. I mean, what are you seeing as far as the...
Well, I think there's one interesting parallel here is that, you know, right when we're stealing all, well, you know, call it what you will, acquiring all this data from these major corporations, it is exactly when we are giving up our own data, which is kind of an interesting parallel, I think. And I've often thought that maybe that would even be some kind of business plan for record labels, like give us more of your data and get it backed up by somebody who knows you in real life so that we can figure out our demographics and do all this marketing type research. But I just think that there's an interesting flow, like just the pipes are opening from both sides. We're getting their data, they're getting our data, and everybody knows a lot more now, which is great.
So, Daniel, I have a question for you, kind of on the launching point of pipes. You know, as with Yahoo, you guys collect a lot of data. How do you think about what's out there for grabs and then maybe what's out there and clearly not for mass consumption but suddenly becomes mass consumption?
Well, it's probably easier for me to approach that from the project I work on. I can't talk about, like, Yahoo's policy.
Now, remember, we're not holding you to any of this here.
I say it because when we launched Pipes, there were a lot of reasons we wanted to be, like, on the Yahoo domain, and part of that was we wanted to be able to extend user information and user data that would allow people to build really customizable applications. But when we launched, we knew that we really wanted to handle this in a very secure fashion. And so some of the types of things that we wanted to enable, like the ability to easily get your IP information and say, you know, automatically fill in location information or whatnot, we didn't kind of tackle those things as customizable things because we take it pretty seriously. And I mean, personally, I definitely don't want to kind of play with people's personal information. I think that that's, you know, these products that are very disruptive, they need to help evolve business practices that are innovative, legal practices that are innovative, all sorts of across the spectrum. It's not just like pushing a product and what you can do with it, but actually hopefully kind of coming up with new ways to think about how do you extend API keys and share those. How do you, because like in our project, for instance, people can use API keys from all sorts of different web services and then put them in the public to be cloned, and all of a sudden something that I built, Peter's now got in, you know, he can see my API key. And, you know, I think we need to work across sort of companies and whatnot to basically come up with standards that are evolving practices that support sort of these projects that are thinking differently about how we use this information. It's not really up to like Yahoo or Pipes. It's up to sort of like all of us. And I think that's where like this evolving set of rules needs to come up.
Do you think we're kind of getting to the point of, you know, essentially what we're talking about is a lot of transparency. Are we kind of headed toward maybe a backlash with transparency?
Well, I mean, there's obviously seeing something like Freebase be launched yesterday. It looks a lot like Google Base. And it'll be interesting to see how like services that maybe already exist in some format at other companies start to come up in maybe in new companies where you maybe don't arrive at it with a perception of how they might be handling your data and might actually be feeling like you're in a position to evolve those practices in ways that, you know, you feel comfortable with. It's one thing to maybe sign up for like a mail account at a service that you know is also a search engine, and you start to wonder, like, what are they doing with the terms that are in my mail, and how is that affecting my search? And it's another to maybe go somewhere else and get mail from a kind of a non, you know, someone who's not offering other services and doesn't have like maybe a conflict of interest. So right. Perhaps it's like maybe coming back to really niche services that people can offer that can actually like not right. be playing both ends.
Pete, what do you think about like the 14-year-olds who are, you know, their whole life is online? Do you think that there's going to be a generation where, you know, they just kind of go in the opposite direction?
You know, I was just thinking about that the other day, how, you know, the kids that are, maybe they're like, you know, 4 years old right now, and they'll sort of look at the generation that came before them and think, that's so square. Like, how could you, you know, blog about everything you're doing? But the funny thing is, if there is a backlash, we might not even know about it since they wouldn't be blogging about it, right? I mean, I think that there's always a chance of that happening. I think if you think about the way youth subcultures have always worked, they've always, you know, they often define themselves in opposition to what is the prevailing tendencies in society. If you look at, you know, punk rock or whatever in the 70s. And so I think it wouldn't surprise me at all if there was a youth subculture that really rebelled against all these new technologies of self-revelation and connectivity and transparency and said, you know, we're going to have a, you know, we're going to, I mean, it's not always intentional, but I mean, you could see it happening in reaction, in opposition to all that. And, you know, kids going back to, I mean, when I was, you know, in college, there was sort of a mini backlash against, you know, technology with like indie kids and punk kids and stuff like that by, you know, rejecting CDs and buying vinyl. And, you know, people are going to think this is hilarious given who I am now, but, you know, 10 or 12 years ago, I used a typewriter, an old 1930s typewriter, and I only bought vinyl records that didn't come from major labels. And that was because it was sort of like defining myself in opposition to, you know, what was mainstream, what was current. And, so I think it'd be great. I think it'd be healthy actually to have something that sort of, kind of puts a little bit of a reality check on things, and I don't think it'll ever be prevalent. I don't think we're going to see a mass rejection of these technologies, just like, you know, people didn't reject television or anything like that. But I think that we probably will see some sort of youth culture that rejects all this stuff.
Right. I was thinking that we could end up with more of like a clicky type thing. Like right now, anybody can get a MySpace account, obviously, and that's. You know, that's why it's such a big deal, because everybody does seem to have one. But I think we're going to reach a point where, you know, we're going to see more private networks where you have to maybe have met somebody in real life to even get the, you know, get the address or, you know.
Oink? Like Oink, the mm-hmm. sort of music sharing network where it's all BitTorrent based, and to sort of get onto the network, you basically have to know somebody.
Right. It's basically like the, I don't know if everybody remembers the FTP ratio file sharing sites that were around before Napster and are still around. And you basically just have to know somebody, and they have to trust you. And I'm in one, not that I use it, but they don't know that I'm a journalist and I could totally just do a story about this guy, which I'm not going to do probably. but you know, I think we could that's how we could get to the point that Pete's talking about, is maybe sort of a clickifying and segmentation of this sort of all for one approach that's prevalent right now.
It reminds me of the Google test that lexicographers have started to use, where you know a word doesn't exist if it's not on Google.
Yeah.
Because as you guys have been talking, I've been thinking that so much of what I try to do is find things that aren't yet online. And then put them online in some way. But then it sort of doesn't happen if you can't blog about it, or if you don't blog about it. And that sort of line between what's online and what isn't, and when something becomes real, when it goes online, I feel like we've kind of lost in a funny way. It doesn't exist anymore.
I think to build on the point that Elliot was making, there's an interesting inflection point that we're hitting, which is that I think there are certain trends that drove a lot of the kind of explosion of social representation online over the last couple of years, and they came out of a certain environment, and that environment is changing. With the sort of increasing sense of financial insecurity and environmental insecurity and political insecurity in the world, I think people continue to feel a need to align themselves against traditional institutional voices and perspectives. And so they're very interested in being part of that dialogue online. But I do think their own personal anxiety is increasing. And I think that is something that always trickles down through, you know, to youth culture. And I think that anxiety is going to change the way people look at those communities and make them feel more vulnerable as a part of those communities and make them feel, and I think this cuts across demographics, this strong desire to begin to associate themselves with, and I use this word in sort of the generic sense, with kind of evangelical voices or some sense of being part of a tribe or a gang or a club, something that fortifies them a little bit more in that world. And that, again, could be based on religious beliefs. It can be based on environmental beliefs. But I do feel like people are going to, until I kind of look at a lot of the trends, and I see them amplifying from last year, amplifying through this year because of all that insecurity, and I kind of feel like the next election in 2008 is going to be the next inflection point where either people start to feel a stronger sense of security in the world and a clearer understanding of kind of a more unified sense of culture and political discourse. But until that point, I think people's insecurity are going to fuel this desire to be a part of a series of evangelical-style communities where there's a strong voice, there's a strong perspective, there's a clear sort of hero myth and something that they can participate in that sort of helps them fortify their life and their role in culture against the insecurities that they see globally. And I think you're seeing that most dramatically right now around the environmental movement, where I think for people it's becoming in part a rallying cry because it gives them such a clear kind of frightening fantasy of the future, which may be reality, but right now the way it's presented through kind of these simulations of, you know, mass flooding of, you know, the entire, you know, Gulf Coast, it kind of, you know, for people very much amplifies that insecurity and creates a way of aligning their behavior that feels much more purposeful and meaningful in today's culture.
That raises a good point. You know, the beauty of the web is, you know, you can have a very niche interest and then suddenly, you know, you're in a community of thousands. And it seems like what you're talking about also kind of leads to, you know, both a good fracturing of a dialogue and then potentially not. You know, from like a design you know, or social perspective, how do you kind of, when people kind of get in their pigeonholes of communication or on a particular topic, kind of, you know, mm-hmm. you mentioned kind of the hero yeah. leader, you know, from a design and even technology perspective, how do you get people to kind of break out of that and maybe cross over to a different dialogue or something, just another influence?
Well, I think one of the challenges we're facing from a design perspective is that there's an amplification of the influence of a lot of micro trends and a lot of these sort of stronger voices. And so you have a lot of companies, big companies right now, trying to figure out how to tap into that emerging behavior and sift through all those different potential kind of influences to find the ones that are really going to have a significant effect on their market. And that's a big kind of opportunity for, I think, people who really understand the intersection of design and social trends to try and help big companies create a sense of security, build some stable strategic direction within that environment. And that's a big thing that we do a lot, is trying to sift through those trends. We call them outliers. When we're interviewing and talking to our clients, very often they're much more interested in outlier behavior than in the conventional behavior in their markets. And so how you interpret that and how you then evaluate that and build it into product strategy, I think, is a growing kind of need that only to some degree design can provide.
Right.
And that had been in some way the role of newspapers, of sort of, you know, broad swath curating of the day's news, of news judgment. And we sort of, there was that whole movement towards news aggregators, which a lot of us use, which sort of removes that. But what's striking to me is how much it feels like we're going back to that, those sort of news judgment, except getting it from blogs rather than from newspapers. So a site like Boing Boing is, you know, picking the best stories of the day and not writing them, but still deciding what goes on the front page and you know what gets smaller treatment and how those things might be balanced and what needs to be returned to the next day. And you know, so we're still looking for that judgment in other places, and certainly not having machines do it, but still yeah. That's
one more thing I'd like to say about that power of the designers. In some ways, we've gotten a lot of our clients and a lot of businesses out there to drink the Kool-Aid in terms of really believing that the voice of the customer is going to show them the way. And it opens very powerful and is causing very powerful changes in the ways that products are developed and the ways that, you know, there's more sort of co-participation and co-creation of things. But at the same time, it puts us in a very powerful position to be able to amplify a single voice and really change the direction of a company based on a single blog post or a single voice or a single sort of persuasive perspective. And there's a burden that goes along with that, because I think that very often that single voice is a great point of leverage, but it's not always, you know, the target that you want to design to. And how you interpret what you're learning from those things is really, I think, a very, very much a responsibility that designers face, and an area where there's kind of a need to continue to grow and evolve the tools that we use so that we're providing an effective role in society as opposed to amplifying some very, you know, myopic trends.
So with the idea of collection and aggregation of content, you know, that kind of leads into customization. It's, you know, generally when you're collecting the info or whatever data it might be, you know, sooner or later somebody wants to hack it. They kind of want to make it their own or do what they expect it to do. You know, I would say, what are some of the examples you guys are seeing of that now? And also, you know, from a design perspective, how do you kind of deal with the balance of, you know, you've got a vision for creating, you know, a product or some type of a design, and then knowing that it's going to get hacked, and it might be an improvement, it might be, you know, something that is just in a totally different direction.
I have an example of this. The I don't know if everybody's familiar with the Akai MPC that a lot of people are using right now. Yeah, it's one guy, right? Is it two guys? One guy in Japan who's written software that's basically updates the firmware of your MPC, and it gives, you can buy the lower end MPC for $1,000, and then you just run this software, and it gives you all the features on like the $2,500 version. And Akai seems to be okay with this because it's just generating interest. And I think the guy's even doing stuff that they haven't even thought of. And so they look at themselves as like, well, we're just going to sell this hardware, and this guy can do whatever he wants. And I think that's a great open attitude, and it's serving them well right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to hardware especially, you know, manufacturers tend to freak out a little bit too much about people modifying or hacking or whatever their devices, because it's usually not going to be something that's going to you know, end up with and being adopted by, you know, huge numbers of consumers. It's usually just going to be like the niche, you know, people, the early adopters that are going to really push and try to get that extra functionality out of their devices. But what it is by appearing, by allowing it, you give the appearance of being more consumer friendly, and you end up pulling in those mass consumers who might not modify the device at all. It kind of gives them that sort of feeling like, well, I could do this stuff if I really wanted to.
I'm kind of still waiting for modification to lead to a stronger commitment to upgradability within the hardware and software that we use, and I feel like that is something that is still, you know, for many people, particularly early technology adopters, is not a strong commitment or belief. And I feel like as we look to some of the other issues that people are very aware of, I feel like a lot of people are very interested, and a lot of businesses are very interested in these secondary economies they can create around not so much customization as augmentation and addition. So what are the extra services, the extra things that we can build onto our product? And businesses are very excited by that idea, but they still are very hooked on making sure their products are pretty disposable. And you know, it's something that that the consumer, I think, and has to really push back on in order for there to be some change in practice and behavior.
Yeah, I think that was what made the iPhone a strange moment, in that it was perfect because it wasn't perfect yet, but maybe it would be soon. You know, it was such an empty vessel for what you might be able to put into it, which kind of reduces the sort of gadget cycle down to zero in a strange way. But that suddenly you know, you and also sort of raises the question of how it will be upgraded. Particularly when objects don't all look the same, when they all sort of lead towards, are heading towards these same flat slabs of screens.
Well, I think, you know, leading off the iPhone, I mean, it's a closed platform, and it's something that is going to be very, very resistant to users actually modifying or enhancing. And I think it's a mistake, actually. I think that, you know, if we look at where if we look at where this stuff is going, it's towards consumers having more control over their devices. And I think you actually want to open up because, you know, when you create a platform that people can innovate upon, you end up enabling the creation of something that actually might make your device more valuable to more people.
This is what I've been calling the Tom Sawyer effect. It's like, It's fun to paint the fence. I'm just going to stand here and eat an apple. Like, please, just paint the fence. It's good. You're going to have a great time painting this fence. And then suddenly the fence is painted. I mean, that's a huge trend right now. And Apple is going to miss out on that with the iPhone unless they open it up.
A lot of these things also come back to the fact that these are like closed networks that these devices are working on. So in the case of like a phone, consumers probably really need to start demanding from the carriers that they're actually signed with to enable the like less restrictions on certification of software applications that run on mobile devices, more openness with regards to the sorts of service query calls that you can make so that you can actually get like location information or do some of the things that they certainly can enable but currently restrict. I don't think it's a surprise that Apple pushed a closed device because I think to get carrier support, they never would have really been able to say, we're going to just open up a virus network potentially to your system. But there are definitely ways to think about, I think, offering hardware hackable devices onto the mobile carrier network that, you know, jive with everyone, especially, I mean, the carriers are going to be in the best position to probably monetize on the sort of hacks and extensions that people make on these devices because they're going to be able to do it better and distribute it further once they see what sorts of things we as consumers start downloading as soon as, like, you know, Joe Hacker puts it up online, whether it's, you know, this turn my phone into an NPC all of a sudden or whatever it might be.
They're so resistant to that. I mean, do you guys think this Linux cell phone idea has any chance? I mean, the carriers, I think that cell phones need to be computers more, and they're just not at all. And they really are going to restrict a lot of the social trends that we're talking about that have happened with computers are not going to be able to happen with cell phones because only the cell phone providers can write the software for these phones, and they tend to favor their own ringtone services, obviously. Like, this is the huge cash cow for them right now. So I think, you know, I think that's one area that really needs to be opened up if we're going to see the same kinds of cool social applications in the mobile space.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a while. I think we're going to have to get to another generation of mobile wireless networks before we start to see that happen.
I think the litmus test, to some degree, is cable cards, and I feel like, you know, they haven't yet really achieved the level or caused a level of innovation that I think many people expect within the home media environment. And I feel like, you know, if an innovation like that can really help drive the openness in terms of hardware and software that people start to embrace and create much more competition in a closed environment like the like the cable systems, I think that it could serve as a great model for other environments like the mobile phones. And I don't know. My advice is for everybody is to go out and buy a cable card and a, you know, the next generation TiVo, and let's have a movement and start to see, you know, the fact that consumer demand and good user experience can become the driver for changing some of these market assumptions and business assumptions that they're making. I think another interesting case is just the fact that they're layering TiVo as an add-on service on a lot of these cable systems to try and see if the software alone is going to drive consumer demand. And it's another place where I feel like people can vote with their dollars and buy, you know, pay for the TiVo DVR instead of the standard DVR just to show people that, you know, these innovations are important enough for people to pay for them.
So before I open up to questions, I've got another one on the innovations, you know, that, you know, we can drive innovations, but, you know, looking around the room, you know, we all signed up for the same conference. So one way or another, we kind of fall into the same demographic bag. You know, what would you guys say are some of the, you know, kind of population trends or demographic trends that are kind of going to influence this whole crux of social and tech?
I would say the baby boomers having grandchildren and their children having large TVs, video cameras, and large pipes upstream. So the sort of the fact that living room video conferencing hasn't come in more quickly is surprising to me. Particularly again with the cable card, I mean that, you know, that if they it's two way with your computer, and it's pretty much nearly one way with your cable television. And sort of all of the infrastructure is falling into place, and yet nobody's really doing it. I know it's been sort of perpetually around the corner, but but it seems logical it'll be coming soon. At the least, my 3-year-old nephew thinks that video chatting is kind of okay, and his 1-year-old brother thinks it's absolutely normal. So that might be the turning point.
I mean, I think you have this combination of aging and an aging population and baby boomers who traditionally felt like they were kind of steering our culture and had a lot of control over the political environment. You have a combination of that and the financial insecurity that I think people are feeling is, you know, sort of a heightened awareness of, and political insecurity. And I think that's going to drive a huge change in behavior within that market in terms of their desire to embrace technologies, but their sense of their need for a sense of control within those technical environments. And I think, you know, one example is Steve Brill and a lot of these security services that are opening up. Sort of premium security services. So Steve Brill started a company where you can essentially have yourself checked up and down and sort of biometrically captured, and you can speed your way through airports. Similarly with the healthcare system, the convergence of imaging and biotechnical advances allowing that population to much earlier on gauge their own sense of longevity and their own potential for long life and their own risk of disease. I think all of those things are going to powerfully impact their role in the political and cultural trends, as well as technical trends in terms of, you know, kind of the services and the tools and the expectations they have for how technology will serve them and give them more control over their home environment, over their home automation. All of these things, I think, are kind of the fortress that generation is going to start building. And I think it's going to have a big influence on the rest of culture.
All right. Well, we're going to open up the panel for questions. So, you know, raise your hand and stand up and, you know, let us know what questions you have. Okay, and so, walk up to the mic in the middle of the room.
Hi. How do international trends affect what we do here in the U.S.?
I'm sorry, the question, how will international trends affect what gets like, here to the,
yeah,
to the U.S.?
Yeah, international social and tech trends, how does that kind of filter down into the United States and like maybe like a timeline, like how long that kind of takes for stuff from the U.K. and Japan to show up here?
I think one example of that is Europe's focus on carbon emissions and the amount of time that it's taken that to become a matter of interest here. And the one place in particular that I think is coming sooner than others in sort of more tangible ways is in the airline industry. In Europe, airlines are talking about being carbon neutral, for example, and it seems like in the next 6 months we'll, or not carbon neutral, at least offsetting part of their carbon, but in the next 6 months that it seems like we might be talking about that as well. And that's one timeline, I think.
I think one way it could happen is we're getting some strange laws these days about, you know, webcasting and what devices can do. And companies that are based in other countries are not beholden to these things. I mean, the RIAA does send representatives to every government in the world to convince them to adopt the DMCA, but it doesn't always work. And as those countries realize that they can make a ton of money by making unlocked devices and offering webcasting services that are more innovative than what we have, I mean, I think that could be a huge driver of it over the next few years.
I also think it comes through with who's on your team designing your projects and products. Ultimately, I can certainly inflect on what I see, but I represent a pretty specific audience, and I can only really, I think, to some extent, reach so far out and see what other people would like. So I think companies and businesses, we sort of have a responsibility to make sure that our teams start reflecting a more international look to them. And actually, we're listening to people whose vantage points aren't exactly, you know, the same as like my look and makeup. Because we shouldn't just be designing, you know, Web 2.0 apps for the audience that adopts Flickr. We should be designing and using like these people who are like, I mean, the brightest minds of our generation are going to like places like, you know, director of programming for NBC. I mean, we need to be thinking maybe bigger about how we use our, you know, what we're seeing and who's making up these products to actually apply them to maybe a better good or to a broader audience. I don't know. That's
it's interesting you say that because it one of the things that I'm seeing is a sort of convergence of futurism and environmentalism. You know, both are thinking about consequences. You know, if you're a futurist, you're thinking of what's coming next is some sort of environmental catastrophe, and so therefore you being a futurist has become the same thing as being an environmentalist, which is a very different thing from going into the wilderness. You know, and that's become a completely different way of thinking about nature.
All right. I was glad that previous question was asked, because it sounded my concern, having worked in the Global South, what are your connections and bridging to the Global South? There's a lot happening down there, and it seems like we're a little bit ostrich in the sand. So what about that connectivity with what's going on in the Global South and the social implications for that?
So the question would be on what's the global connection of self with the
South.
Latin America, Africa.
I'll take that one. I'm starting to see, particularly in Africa, the sort of focus on building out broadband networks and the potential that for essentially sort of a new call center and new service economy hotspots. The infrastructure isn't quite there, but it's getting there. And certainly the possibility, both in terms of population and education, is huge, as well as investment from China. Somebody mentioned to me the other day that their read on why China was investing so much in African infrastructure was as a population escape valve, the sort of potential of the reason to build infrastructure in Africa from China's perspective is as a place to send their growing population, which I thought was an amazing comment.
I think one of the biggest shifts we're going to see is that outside of the U.S. and maybe Europe, most people access the internet through a mobile device, through a cell phone, and I think that that's going to be sort of eventually the predominant, if it's not already, the predominant internet experience for most people on the planet. And I think we have to sort of start to factor that into account. What is that experience like? What kind of internet is accessible through the mobile web? And what sort of experiences are you able to have on a device like that? And, the typical internet experience for someone in Africa or Latin America or South Asia is not going to be sitting at an expensive, overpowered PC in their home. It's going to be on probably an underpowered last-generation mobile device.
Interesting. We're definitely seeing an explosion in terms of client interest in looking at how, and client expectation that there's some way in which the services that we're designing for them can be adapted easily across markets, but they're definitely still focused very much on developed markets. I think while I think from a social perspective, people's awareness of what's happening in the Global South, as you talked about it, has increased dramatically in the last year. I think that it hasn't really penetrated in terms of how people are looking at the communication tools and services they're creating. And I think it's something that is still at a very early stage for a lot of the companies that are making a lot of the policy decisions. I think we, Frog particularly, is part of a company that has resources in India, and I think India is a very interesting sort of flashpoint between the issues of a developed nation and the issues of a very underdeveloped nation. And I was reading about a service they offer called the ePost, which essentially allows somebody in the sort of rural underdeveloped areas of India to receive an email from the postal service. They actually, you can send an email into the postal service, and they will print it out and deliver it as in a physical envelope to any part of the country. And conversely, they can write a letter to an email address, and it'll be delivered to the post office. The post office will type it in, and it'll be transmitted to that email address. So there are very different kinds of adaptations between kind of physical manifestations of social trends and technologies and the more networked environments that we're used to that are kind of emerging as hybrids. And I think that there's a lot of interesting opportunities to look at those kind of services.
One of the things I've noticed in terms of like packages or projects that I've noticed coming out of the South have been things that are sort of subversive in nature, because many of the networks are very closed or dictator run. So, you know, VoIP, for instance, as an example, would be the sort of thing that, you know, you can't really run in India without state approval. And, you know, this is pretty prevalent across Africa as well. So lots of packages like Babuni, which is like an open source MMS gateway, or Canel, which is an open source SMS gateway. These are both software projects that have come out of the South and are sort of coming up as a resilient backlash to the fact that there were no provider services to actually enable a population to kind of speak amongst themselves in ways that they wanted to. And so, I mean, if you go into some of like the network infrastructure, I mean, a lot of people, I don't know, I was at the O'Reilly Emerging Telephony Conference, and there were a lot of representatives that weren't that open to talk about what they worked on back home because of fear of being quoted or whatnot, but it was pretty clear that they were there to learn about these enabling technologies that could allow them to subversively open up these new networks and kind of go around their, you know, the laws of their country. So in some ways, I think it's going to be basically watching how these develop and seeing how we can support them, you know, so that we're not just the only ones on the network.
Okay. Want to go ahead and ask the next question, please?
I was wondering what your opinions on education and how the education system could be changed in light of these social trends, in particular, maybe higher education, or any opinions you had on how these trends could influence the way we teach students.
Okay. Andrew?
I won't pretend to offer any suggestions or solutions for changing higher education, but one thing which hopefully would be useful to think about is the Board of Ed in New York just signed a $12 million contract with IBM on Monday for essentially a full grading database program, all of which is coming out of the No Child Left Behind need for metrics. So the sort of the need to put that in the computer and get everyone's grading book centralized and having them be accessible for both statistics at a citywide or statewide level and also by parents is becoming recognized, and also perhaps pushing education towards more testing based, towards more metrics.
I do think that there's a growing awareness of the need to connect together lots of different aspects of sort of the way that students learn through games, through their activities online, through their activities in schools. And I think that there's an area where there are some innovative programs. Frog's involved with a pretty significant education client in this area, just trying to figure out how to create tools that the education system, as traditionally constructed, the school system, really doesn't have either the resources or the sort of knowledge base or the relationships to start to bring together all these just different aspects of learning. And I think as there's a growing awareness of the value of games and play and learning, you'll see, hopefully, more innovation in that area.
There have been some interesting schools that have certainly leveraged technology. And if you look at, like, the Ross School or even the Columbia School for Kids in the upper New York, they have very innovative classrooms, and I think that, you know, one thing that's been interesting is to see how, you know, I mean, I'm not sure that this is the best example, but like every student is getting laptops. Every you know, classroom has like these digital whiteboards. I know a friend is teaching like a music class to students at Columbia that is basically trying to encourage kids how to use like GarageBand and music software to basically be very creative. I mean, there have been some really cool albums that students have done with teachers that I think one is called Little Rascals or something along those lines. It was a teacher in the Bronx who basically kind of brought all this technology to the students and helped them basically record their own songs and didn't get involved in sort of sequencing and editing. But, you know, what was interesting was that these kids made really very deconstructed and interesting songs that, like, you know, I think a lot of people who start making music maybe first make, where you don't have the rules and you don't feel you're not so conformed. So it's just like putting things in front of people and enabling them, feeling comfortable to actually play with the space feels like one really important thing. Google's also offered they have a whole suite of applications that I think brings together like groups and their Docs program, and they have like an initiative, I believe it's like for for teachers and educational institutions. So I think we're seeing it a little bit. I mean, it's a pretty resourceful, there's so many resources out there now to go on that it's, you no longer have to really like go to a, you can get online and get access to information. It's kind of, how do you apply it creatively and ensure that, you know, you're not just using it because someone's telling you it's cool, but it actually solves a problem.
Okay. We've got time for one question and brief answers.
What's the future for email, and do you think it'll be replaced by messaging and SMS?
Just really short, I don't think email's going anywhere. I mean, I think it's a pretty perfect application. I mean, asynchronous communication, you know, nobody has to be on the other end. I mean, that's my personal take. I don't know.
I do think video conferencing is going to come in a different way. I don't know if anyone has seen the Halo room that Hewlett Packard is selling for $500,000 a piece. But without delay, with sort of three high definition screens, with a fixed environment, an environment that's sort of, rather than saying we're bridging place, I'm talking from my place to your place, but instead we're sort of gathering in a single hybrid physical virtual place. Suddenly it changes and it becomes something totally different from any other communication, email, phone, traditional video conferencing, and that there aren't many barriers left to that getting a lot cheaper.
Yeah, with all the huge displays in people's homes, I think telepresence is something that will has the potential to really start to change and amplify and influence social interaction. Throw in the sort of carbon effects of air travel, and maybe there's a heady mix for something to explode. I don't know if it's going to be $600,000 Halo rooms or just, you know, better high definition. The ability to buy, I don't know, coming back to some points we made earlier, the ability to purchase premium network access to be able to support those kind of services through your cable provider, the ability to purchase premium access through to security services, to healthcare services. I think that whole market is a place where we're going to start to see some dichotomies in society that are going to be rather painful in terms of the way we look at the world and on a global level.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. And feel free to wander up if you've got specific questions for any of the panelists.